Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Former First Lady Nancy Reagan has died at the age of 94. The entertainment news site TMZ first reported her death Sunday. The wife of U.S. President Ronald Reagan for more than five decades until his death served as First Lady from 1981 to 1989. We'll bring you more information on her death as it becomes available. Egypt Sunday accused the Palestinian Islamist movement Hamas and the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood of involvement in last year's killing of the country's top prosecutor, Hisham Barakat. The Interior Minister said that 14 members of the Muslim Brotherhood participated directly in the plan to murder Barakat, who was assassinated in a car bomb attack on June 29th. He says the plot was carried out on orders of the Muslim Brotherhood in close coordination with Hamas, which played a very important role in the assassination of the chief prosecutor from start to finish. That's his comment to reporters. Nearly 5 million eligible voters in the West African nation of Benin are expected to cast their ballot Sunday for the country's next president. 33 candidates are running to succeed Thomas Boni Yayi. He's leaving office after the legally mandated two terms. He told reporters as he cast his ballot that he was leaving behind a unified Benin. Prominent Sudanese politician Hassan al-Turabi was buried Sunday in a cemetery east of the capital of Khartoum following a funeral attended by thousands of mourners. Turabi died Saturday of a heart attack at the age of 84. He once played a major role in the 1989 coup that brought down President Omar al-Bashir to power. You're listening to VOA News. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani says his security forces have uprooted loyalists of the Islamic State in Afghanistan. Addressing lawmakers at the opening of Parliament in Kabul Sunday, he said IS is one of the elements in the current Afghan conflict, but it's only fighting to promote its own extremist ideology and interests. He says, we can say that with pride that today Afghanistan is the only nation where Daesh is on the run. They're on the run in Nangarhar, and Afghanistan will be their graveyard. That's according to Ghani. A suicide attack in the Iraqi city of Hilla Sunday has killed at least 47 people and wounded scores of others. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for that bombing. A police official says the attacker drove an explosives-filled fuel truck into a security checkpoint about 115 kilometers south of Baghdad. That checkpoint was filled with dozens of cars who are awaiting entrance into the city. And among the dead are civilians and security personnel. More than 40 people were wounded. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today welcomed a visit by U.S. Vice President Joe Biden. He says the visit is a testament to the strong relations between Israel and its ally, the United States. Netanyahu made the comments during a weekly cabinet meeting. Biden's last visit to Israel in 2010 sparked a diplomatic spat with Washington when Israel announced settlement construction plans during Biden's visit. Slovakia's leftist ruling party will begin negotiations Sunday with smaller political parties in an attempt to form a coalition government after losing its parliamentary majority in Saturday elections. With nearly all the votes counted, Prime Minister Robert Fico's Smer Social Democracy Party won nearly 30% of the vote, securing 49 seats in the 150-seat parliament, losing its secure majority of 83 seats in the previous government. Chinese President Xi Jinping has issued a strong warning to Taiwan and its incoming independence-leaning government. According to the official Xinhua news agency, President Xi told delegates to the annual meeting of China's parliament Sunday that Beijing will resolutely contain Taiwan independence secessionist activities in any form and will never allow the historical tragedy of a split to occur again. China and Taiwan have been split since 1949 when Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist forces fled the mainland after losing the civil war to Mao Zedong's communist army. You'll hear more details on this and more 24 hours a day at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We have provisions for the sponsorship of at least 4 children of the deceased officer or soldier, you know, right from the primary school, secondary school, which is high school, and of course, tertiary institution.
The Nigerian Army promises to sponsor the education of children of soldiers who died in the fight against Boko Haram.
You know, if the Minister of Defense signed a confidential note that there are terrorists in town, any normal human being should be afraid. That's why I've decided not to go out.
Panic grips Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, after a letter from Defense Minister states that Boko Haram terrorists have arrived in the city.
There were people in rural area that depend on agricultural activity. Now they are in new environment in town. For us, we want to train them so that they can know skill on business.
And an NGO in South Sudan trains displaced women on how to run small businesses so they can provide for themselves and their families. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria's army has announced that it will sponsor education of 4 children of each soldier that died in the counter-insurgency fight against Islamic militant group Boko Haram. A cross-section of Nigerians have welcomed the announcement but also urged the army to ensure the families of the fallen soldiers do not face challenges to access the scheme due to corruption and incompetence, which they said often permeate state institutions. Nigeria's military spokesman Colonel Sani Kukashika Usman says the army has established an insurance policy for the soldiers to ensure the families they leave behind are properly taken care of.
Yeah, as you are quite aware, we have a welfare scheme for both officers and soldiers of the Nigerian Army, especially to their respective dependents or next of kin in event of inevitable or unforeseen falling them. For instance, in the course of duty, if one is injured or wounded or paid the ultimate price of losing his or her life, his family will adequately be taken care of. Apart from the routine administrative arrangements we have, we also have the group life insurance. And, of course, we have provisions for the sponsorship of at least 4 children of the deceased officer or soldier, you know, right from the primary school, secondary school, which is high school, and, of course, tertiary institution.
What if the military person has more than... Our soldier has more than 4 children. What happens to that?
Well, the thing is that the system or rather the service recognizes the number of 4 because for obvious reasons, you know, it has a strain over the budget. And, of course, the number came about simply because of studies and it was proven beyond reasonable doubt that hardly you have more than 4 biological children, you know. At the same time, you know. But basically, it was decided that at least 4 is a reasonable number.
We've heard the army has made some progress and that they are pushed to the heartland of the Sambisa forest in the fight against Boko Haram. What is the latest development on that front?
We have our troops, you know, combing every nook and cranny of isolated community, clearing the remnants of Boko Haram terrorists, and with each passing day, they are inching towards the main heartland of the Boko Haram terrorists in Sambisa Forest. Yesterday, they were able to clear Boko Haram terrorists in some notorious part of the Sambisa Forest, Dure and so many other places. And when you look at it, on the axis of Bama, Goza, and even the northern fringes of Borno State, the clearing is ongoing and with tremendous success in the sense that quite a number of terrorists were killed, some were captured. Take, for instance, just yesterday, when Musa Abdullahi was captured by our troops, and of course he gave insight about some of the atrocities being committed, and we were able to recover quite a number of equipment too and weapons. But one thing I want you to understand is that these guys are unrelenting in the sense that they, with each passing day, they come out with a new strategy. For instance, they tend to use even communication gadgets to set up a booby trap, apart from the normal improvised explosive devices they bury on the ground. But our troops are up to the task. And, of course, the issue of contaminating even the source of drinking water in the communities, you know, where they have been routed out.
We heard reports that they are now selling cattle to fund their operations. What are the intelligence gathering that you've gotten as a result of capturing some of the their fighters?
Well, as you know, initially they were having a field day. And, you know, there was this kind of trust among the communities, a thing that you least expected to happen. But as we close onto their respective supply routes, denying them freedom of action, freedom of movement, and, of course, source of logistic supplies, they devised several other means, you know, using a third party, either by way of trading some goods and maybe animals. So these are the kind of things that happened, and that was what led to the closure of some of the markets, you know, because some of the markets act as a kind of meeting point for some of them. And, of course, they graduated to use of selling cattle to raise funds for their nefarious activities. And we are closing on to that. With each passing day, we get information and intelligence, and we act on it. And I can rest assure you confidently that the fight against terrorism and insurgency in Nigeria, is we are gaining tremendous success. And in no distant time, it's something that we can beat our chest and say, yes, peace and stability and security has come to stay in our country.
Colonel Sani Kuka Shika Usman is the Nigerian military spokesman. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Panic has gripped Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, after a confidential letter from the country's Minister of Defense leaked to social media stating that Boko Haram terrorists had arrived in the city. The letter called for vigilance and additional deployment of troops to ministerial buildings and public areas such as markets, churches and schools. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé that some residents have decided to stay indoors.
Businesswoman Belinda Tata says when she received information through social media that Cameroon's Defense Minister Joseph Betti Asomo had issued a confidential letter urging the military to stop a possible terrorist attack in the capital, she decided to avoid all public places and gatherings.
You know, if the Minister of Defense signed a confidential note that there are terrorists in town, any normal human being should be afraid. That's why I've decided not to go out, because I'm too scared.
Military officials say the leak occurred due to lapses in their information system. The confidential letter to top military officers called for increased security at government buildings, army barracks, military hospitals, and crowded public places. It also called for collaboration between the public and vigilante groups. Adren Joya, an official at a private security company that filters access to major hotels in Yaoundé, says he deployed more of his staff to areas where they work when they were informed of the threats.
Il faut bien filtrer, même ceux qui disent qu'ils sont nos frères.
He says because the enemy is at work, he has asked his staff to thoroughly search everyone, even their brothers and sisters who come visiting. He says everyone visiting the hotel should be identified. Defense Minister Asomo has said there were terrorism threats in Yaoundé. He has instructed the head of the brigade that protects citizens in the capital to track suspects immediately.
Je vous rappelle que le calme relatif qui règne dans notre capitale ne doit
He says the military should be vigilant because only an apparent peace or uneasy calm reigns in the capital. He says research and intelligence gathering should be intensified immediately, and economic activity, political institutions, diplomatic missions, and all foreigners living in Cameroon should be protected. He says terrorism threats are real in Cameroon's capital. Since their insurgency spilled over into Cameroon some 3 years ago, Boko Haram terrorists have operated only on the country's northern border with Nigeria. No attacks have been reported in the southern parts of the Central African state. Historically, large open markets, hotels, parks, and sporting venues have been targeted by terrorists. Some countries have advised their citizens to maintain restrictions on travel to northern Cameroon, especially traveling within 100 kilometers of the border with Nigeria's Adamawa and Borno states. Diplomatic missions, including the U.S. Embassy in Yaoundé, have urged expatriates to exercise caution. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Deputy Secretary General of the UN, Jan Eliasson, says he is very pleased with the ongoing global effort to implement the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, countries committed to implement to improve the lives of their citizens. Last year, over 190 world leaders pledged their commitment to 17 SDGs to end extreme poverty, fix climate change, as well as fight inequality and injustice in a bid to attain equitable, more prosperous and sustainable world. In part two of the interview, Mr. Eliasson told me the UN is happy that member states created a set of goals which could positively change the paths toward development within the next 15 years.
Well, I think one of the weak spots of the goals is that we must admit that we don't have the strong basis of data that we should have. I met once the Finnish president who said something at a meeting when we were speculating about something. He just said very calmly, listen, the source of wisdom is knowing the facts.
Right.
And we don't quite know the facts. The statistical structures in many countries is pretty weak. And I think one of the things we have to do is now already at this stage to develop and help with the collection of data, mm-hmm. so that we have a stronger basis of taking action. As to peer review, this is pretty controversial. It is seen by some countries as an interference in internal affairs, but we have accepted that system in the human rights area, for instance. We have universal periodic reviews. Mm-hmm. So I think some type of peer process to see how others are doing it is a good one, mm-hmm. but is a good idea. But it's up to member states to decide, not least at that meeting in July in New York, mm-hmm. whether they will go that direction or not. But I'm very glad that there is more movement than I would have expected for the implementation of the goals. Mm-hmm. Of states. Mm-hmm.
Talking about migration, some people have expressed concern that Turkey's concern hasn't been addressed with the issue of the migration crisis that the conflict in Syria has generated. What is your take?
4 days ago, I was at the border between Syria and Turkey. I saw camps, both container camps and tent camps, with 15,000 people. I spent a whole day talking to refugees, talking to Syrian teachers who were trying to teach their own students. I talked to families that had been split, had lost family members. And then after that, I went to Ankara and met with the government, the prime minister. I went to Istanbul. I saw the president there for another conference. And I was struck by, first of all, the human plight, the horrible realities of seeing a child who doesn't see a future and whose parents are also, you see in their blank eyes, who don't think there is a future. The hopelessness that was there. It was too touching and moving. But then also you saw that they all wanted, practically, the ones I spoke to, come back, go back to their home countries, whether it was Aleppo, mm-hmm. Idlib, or Homs, cities that had been destroyed. Someone has to rebuild. And then I was struck by the fact that the Turkish government, after all, remember, they are receiving 2.5 million people out of a population of 70, 80 million.
Right.
And there is no sign that I could detect of polarization, you know, us and them, and pointing to refugees as a problem, as we unfortunately see, both in Europe and the United States. So and they had put a lot of money and resources into those programs. So under the circumstances, they have really dealt with it very diligently. We hope also that the refugees that are now gathering at the border at some stage will be able to enjoy the generosity of the Turkish people. Mm-hmm. And that depends in turn on whether we will see the cessation of hostilities. We are looking at every hour, I'm looking at my cell phone to see how it is. Mm-hmm. I was myself part of the negotiations in Munich, where we negotiated the humanitarian access and the cessation hostilities. Mm-hmm. Humanitarian access has made great progress. In the world of bad news, I can tell you, we are sending in humanitarian assistance to 130,000 people. We have sent 125 some trucks into areas that were closed.
What are your views about the new process to select or choose a new UN General Secretary General?
Well, I know one thing. We will have a new Secretary General by the 1st of January.
Right.
And the Security Council, of course, has a very key role. But it is interesting to note that the General Assembly has reminded the Security Council that it is, in fact, the General Assembly that makes the final decision at the recommendation of the Security Council. Mm-hmm. So for the first time that I can recall, and I have spent a lot of years in the UN, the General Assembly will play a very active role in the selection process.
Right
now, the member states are sending in names to the President General Assembly and the President Security Council. And by April, May, I'm told that they will have hearings with the candidates. Mm-hmm. So they will be exposed to all member states and to their questions they need to have answers to. And then I understand the Security Council will start their process of selection. And in the end, there will be a recommendation from the Security Council, I'm sure.
Jan Eliasson is the Deputy Secretary General of the UN. He spoke with me from the VOA headquarters here in Washington, D.C. In South Sudan, a local NGO is training displaced women on how to run small businesses so they can provide for themselves and their families. Hundreds of people who fled their homes to escape recent violence in rural parts of Wau County are living in crowded homes with relatives in Wau town. The Women's Development Group says equipping the IDPs with new life skills will allow them to become self-reliant. For VOA, Michael Atit has this report from Wau.
A trainer interacts with several women taking part in the small business skills training workshop in Wau. Anthony Albino Miskin, coordinator for Women Development Group in Wau, says many families who fled to Wau town from rural areas have nothing. Albino says his group is training more than 50 displaced women on how to start a small-scale business.
They were people in rural area, they depend on agricultural activity. Now they are in new environment in town. For us, we want to train them so that they can know skill on business environment, and how to deal with the customer, how you can manage your business, how to make a plan for the business.
Albino says, following the training, each of the women will be given 1,000 South Sudanese pounds to start a business of their choice. 36-year-old Farida Fausto, a mother of five who fled the fighting from Frajala, says members of an armed group burned all her belongings, leaving her with nothing. Fausto says after gaining business skills she learned from the NGO, she will return to her village where she hopes to set up a small business. Speaking in Arabic, she says she has learned how to manage the little money she earns through tea making and how to maintain the capital grant.
Wau is a town and is so costly because in the village we don't buy anything like charcoal, firewood, or water. Now we are here in the town, and it has affected our life, and this training is good to help us being in new life here. We are really appeal to our government and opposition group to come together and solve their differences so we can go back to our normal life in the village.
46-year-old Assunta Marco Kola, a mother of eight, fled violence in Gisa area. She says, although she found life in Wau too difficult, she has learned a lot from skills training and hope to start a new life here. Speaking in Arabic, Kola says, she would like to start selling charcoal, peanut butter, and maize flour in front of her house in Wau.
I'm ready to start selling charcoal on the street, and it will help me to find something to keep my kids alive. I have learned how to keep the capital money and how to use the benefits wisely. I think our life will improve here in the town.
Albino says his organization will follow up with the trainees after a month to see what progress they have made. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
In Zimbabwe, the failure to offer attractive conditions of service for health professionals has resulted in lack of specialists in most state-owned hospitals. They include speech therapists who play a critical role in linking medical professionals with clients. VOA correspondent Patricia Mudadigwa reports.
Speaking at a health workshop on the visual and hearing impaired held in Harare, Michele Angelet, country representative of Christian Blind Mission, said the majority of poor people in Zimbabwe had no access to speech therapists.
Right now, there is not a single speech therapist working in public service in Zimbabwe. We as CBM, we are trying to support the establishment of a Bachelor of Sciences in Speech Therapy and Audiology at the University of Zimbabwe. We are establishing speech therapy services at Harare Children's Hospital. The point is, you see, we are trying as much as possible to complement, but what you can do as parliamentarians, you can advocate whenever budget times come. Because the freezing of the posts right now, that is forced given the economic situation, is hurting the service provision.
This was confirmed by Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Health and Child Care, Dr. Gerald Gwinji, who told the same workshop that the government does not have money to pay salaries of these specialists.
These are very sellable people. As soon as you train them and you don't pay them properly, they go. It's not an issue of us not training. It's an issue of us failing to retain them.
Ruth Labode, chairperson of the Parliamentary Committee on Health and Child Care, said adoption of a disability policy will compel the government to ensure the presence of specialist medical personnel at public hospitals.
And yet the issue is the policy document. And the policy document, 10 years has been in the ministry.
Gwinji concurred, adding that there was need for Zimbabwe to urgently adopt a disability policy. He said work on the policy had commenced.
Consultations were done, and the primary ministry is now finalizing issues around validation on this policy.
Some people living with disabilities who attended the workshops bemoan the failure by government to meaningfully invest in the health sector to lower-skilled medical personnel and specialists. According to a disability activist, Barbara Nyangairi, speech therapists play a critical role in people's lives, including those with problems related to their senses.
Speech therapy makes use of residual senses. And for those that are able to acquire some speech, it is important for you to be able to provide speech therapy for them so that they are then able to use those residual senses more effectively.
However, Nyangairi said while a disability policy is important in Zimbabwe, what is more critical for the country's implementation of such policies?
Zimbabwe already has a lot of good policies. A disability policy would provide a holistic sum of all the things that are provided for within our legal framework in order to operationalize them.
According to health experts, speech-language pathologists, sometimes called speech therapists, assess, diagnose, treat and help to prevent communication and swallowing disorders in patients. This is Patricia Mdadigwa.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Zuna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's kick off with athletics. Rabat will become the first African city to host a Diamond League meeting later this year, but New York has been dropped from the calendar. The Moroccan capital will host this season's third meeting on May 22nd. IAAF President Lord Coy said in a statement that the General Assembly of the Diamond League meeting in Zurich, Switzerland, has decided to include Rabat, Morocco, as a new host city for the prestigious global series of one-day athletics meetings. Rabat replaces New York with immediate effect for the 2016 season. The U.S. retains one Diamond League meeting in Eugene, Oregon. Morocco has previously hosted other IAAF events, including the 2014 Intercontinental Cup in Marrakech. Now, the 2016 IAAF Diamond League calendar stands as follows. It kicks off in Doha, Qatar on May 6th, moves to Shanghai, China on May 14th, on 22nd May to be Rabat, Morocco, May 28th is Eugene, USA, then Rome, Italy hosts on June 2nd, Birmingham, Great Britain is on June 5th, also Norway is on June 9th, Stockholm, Sweden will be June 16th, Monaco will be on July 15th, and then the London Marathon in Great Britain will be on 22nd to 23rd July. Lausanne in Switzerland follows on August 25th. Paris, France will be August 27th. Then Zurich, Switzerland will be on September 1st. And then conclude in Brussels, Belgium on September 9th. Still in athletics, Kenyan David Rudisha on Saturday began the Olympic year with a win in the 800 meters at the IAAF World Challenge meeting in Melbourne. In his first outing for 2016, Rudisha clocked 1:44.78. 20-year-old Australian Luke Matthews chased Rudisha all the way home, smashed his personal best by more than a second. Matthews' 1:45.16 was his first time under the Olympic qualifying standard. Rudisha and Matthews were the standouts of the meeting, traditionally strong on middle distance, but there were also impressive performances from Ryan Gregson in winning the 1500 meters and Madeline Hills in the women's steeplechase. In football, the second edition of the FIFA Women's Football and Leadership Conference will take place on Monday, March 7th. A statement from FIFA says the conference, entitled Equality Through Reform, brings together a wide range of voices from sport and wider society to discuss ways in which women's football and women in football can be further promoted, particularly in light of FIFA's recent reforms. New FIFA President Gianni Infantino, Abe Wambach, Christine Heto, Sunil Gulati, and tennis legend Billie Jean King are among the high-profile figures who will be speaking. The conference coincides with the annual celebration of International Women's Day, which takes place the following day on March 8th, and provides an annual focus point for women in sports and leadership. It also forms part of FIFA's commitment to promote, develop, and invest in women's football so that the sport and those who play it can grow to their full potential across the world. Finally, in boxing, Lucas Brownie stopped defending champion Russian Chagayev in the 10th round to win the WBA heavyweight title in Russia. The Australian, who is managed by Rick Hatton, was knocked down in the 6th round but floored Uzbekistan's Chagayev with a big right. Browne, who improves his record 24 wins with no defeat, followed up with a series of right hooks before the referee intervened. Britain's Tyson Fury is considered the WBA's heavyweight super champion, as he also holds the WBO version. In Birmingham, London's Bradless Kitty won a unanimous points decision to take the British and Commonwealth welterweight title from Sam Eggington. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. So back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Yeah, I want to low, I want to lola, I want to la la vie. I want to low, I want to lola, I want to la la vie. Canteen. Now we don't upgrade the matter. Daily and weekly and monthly and quarter. Now we don't talk to butter. Family this smile and we know the quanta. That we just say Yoruba. Make them know go forget say Badona Baba.
Break 'em, break 'em, break 'em, break 'em, sugar. party, eh. Saturday for a party, eh. Holiday for a party, eh. We go go on a holiday, eh. I want to say this a lot. I want your body just to say a lot. But you lose a lot. Oh boy, your body, they make me they dance. See that you, they make my head, they go. Kologo, eh.
Kologo.
And I just, they love your body, so. Walango, eh.
Walango.
And my heart and soul is up for you, my baby, yeah.
Me, they sing songs. I
bad like King Kong. Hey, Iye Galaba, Iye Galaba, Iye Galaba, Iye Galaba.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one month's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Ampass the inability to resolve acute crisis in the African continent has become the conclusive note of the African Union. Two case studies will illustrate the point. South Sudan represents a troubling factor for Africa. Many Africans were pleased when South Sudan attained its independence. But sadly, a manufactured crisis created great horror for the people of South Sudan. Soon, there were fighting taking place between South Sudanese factions. Huge number of crises, and the international community became alarmed. The African Union tried its hand at negotiations, and much progress was made. Finally, after many, many months of negotiations, an agreement was reached. But always in South Sudan, there are the troublemakers, those who do not want peace and will find all ways and means by their actions or statements to nibble against any progress. And so it was in South Sudan. And in this context, the African Union has not been able to tackle the issues. In the first instance, the government of Salva Kiir, without proper consultation, created a number of states, and this created a problem for the faction of Riek Machar. But soon, they were taking other steps, which seems to go well for negotiations. For example, an agreement was reached for cabinet. Then it was agreed that Riek Machar would be restored to his position of first vice president before the so-called coup was announced. Now we are again an impasse because no one should be fooled. Riek Machar will never go to the capital of South Sudan unless security is guaranteed. And there is yet no agreement on that score. And as I said, the African Union has not been able to make much progress. The second case study is more comical. Everyone knows that the crisis in Burundi was created by the Nkurunziza government when, against all advice and warning, he bulldozed his way to a third term. And what followed is clear to all, outflow of refugees. But again, there were progress made in the negotiations. But when it seems that agreement was being attained, things fell apart. The African Union Peace and Security Council decided it would send 5,000 troops to Burundi to ensure security while negotiations continue. But this never happened because the summit meeting of the AU failed to back the Peace and Security Council. Instead, what we have is a mild proposal of some military officers and human rights forces. And what has happened then is the government of Burundi has manipulated the situation, and we have now a situation we have forgotten what is the origin of the crisis, and now the blame is being placed on those from the outside who are said to be instigating the forces inside Burundi. Now, this was not supposed to happen in the changed African Union. When the African Union was transformed from the Organization of African Unity, OAU, we hear a lot of talk that sovereignty will not be a factor, that social security groups will have more say. But this has not happened. The African Union has remained an African club of presidents, and there is no way these presidents would take action which may jeopardize their own future. So this is a terrible development in Africa, and it may be necessary to return to the drawing board to see how best Africa can negotiate. It is not going to be easy. Look at what has happened in the European Union on the refugees. But at least Africa should not fool itself. It should not pretend that we have an organization can resolve crisis. The African Union, as it presently constituted, cannot resolve crisis in the African continent. I thank you.
That was Woman's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, the road doesn't tell the traveler what lies ahead. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Last year, malaria sickened over 214 million people across the globe and killed some 438,000 of them. And although the disease is relatively common in tropical and subtropical regions, 90% of the deaths occurred in Africa. Most of them were children under 5 years of age. But consider that since the turn of the century, deaths from malaria have fallen by half. According to the World Health Organization, in the year 2000, 985,000 people succumbed to the disease. Today, malaria is in retreat due to a strong global push to reduce deaths and illness. More than 100 countries are now malaria-free, and another 57 cut their incidence of malaria by at least three quarters. 10 years ago, President George W. Bush founded the President's Malaria Initiative, a historic U.S. government effort to lead the fight against malaria. His successor, President Barack Obama, expanded the effort, eventually doubling its funding. Today, the initiative focuses on 19 of the hardest-hit countries in sub-Saharan Africa and three countries in Southeast Asia. Our investment has been well worth the effort. Since the launching of the President's Malaria Initiative, or PMI, led by USAID and implemented together with the CDC, overall mortality rates among children under 5 years of age have significantly decreased in the target countries, anywhere from 18% in both Liberia and Nigeria to 55% in Senegal and Zambia. Last year alone, PMI funded the spraying of the homes of over 16 million people and procured around 42 million long-lasting insecticide-treated bed nets. The United States also provided 60 million anti-malarial treatments and more than 54 million rapid diagnostic tests. In his State of the Union address in January, President Obama set forth a long-term vision of ending the disease. Noting that the end of HIV/AIDS is now within our grasp, he said, "We have the chance to accomplish the same thing with malaria." For that reason, the Obama administration requested from the U.S. Congress an extra $200 million to fight malaria worldwide, which would bring next year's total U.S. funding for prevention and treatment of the disease to $874 million. With additional funds, PMI will increase support to malaria-affected countries to further reduce malaria deaths and substantially decrease malaria illness toward the long-term goal of elimination. The United States is committed to ending this disease that prematurely ends the lives of so many people, especially children. And we call on all our partners, including non-governmental and international organizations, countries, and communities, to join our efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.